This week, what I'd like to do is to begin a new series of presentations on the five hindrances. The five hindrances to, these are obstacles, these are blockages that we experience in the meditation process. And in a certain extent, this topic is a little bit more intimate in the sense that it has to do with the meditation process itself, you know, as opposed to sort of a general Dharma talk on, you know, philosophical issues with respect to Buddhism. The five hindrances, as generally sort of presented and discussed in the classical Theravadan literature, are basically sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, and skeptical doubt. And they are regarded as impediments and hindrances or overgrowths of the mind that stultify insight. So what I'd like to do today is basically begin with sensual desire, or the whole concept of desire and craving, which is really fundamental to the understanding of, you know, the Four Noble Truths and the whole sort of teachings of the Buddha. What I want to do is basically begin with the sort of classical teachings, pretty much as presented in this booklet called The Five Mental Hindrances by Jnanaponika Thera. Jnanaponika Thera is regarded as one of the foremost scholars and teachers and writers in Theravadan Buddhism. He's since passed away, but he was actually a German monk who lived in Sri Lanka and was the founder, the chief editor for many, many years of what is today known as the Buddhist Publication Society, and acknowledged to be one of the finest publication sort of houses for Theravadan Buddhist literature. So Jnanaponika Thera is really regarded as one of the sort of most respected writers in Theravadan Buddhism. So what I'd like to do is basically sort of present his teachings and also annotations or quotations from the classical sutras on the five hindrances, specifically on sensual desire, and then sort of elaborate a little bit in terms of sort of bringing into more of a sort of modern context in terms of our understanding of how desire, how craving and desire works, you know, in the mind and its effect on meditation, on mindfulness meditation. To quote Jnanaponika Thera, he begins with this statement: "One whose heart is overwhelmed by unrestrained covetousness, will do what he should not do and neglect what he ought to do. And through that, his good name and his happiness will come to ruin." And he continues on to say, "One whose heart is overwhelmed by ill will, by sloth and torpor, by restlessness and remorse, by skeptical doubt, in the same way will do what he should not do and neglect what he ought to do, and through this his good name and his happiness will come to ruin." Now this is an important section here. How does a monk practice mind-object contemplation on the mental objects of the five hindrances? So how does a monk, you know, bring mindfulness to bear in terms of looking at these five hindrances? So he begins by saying, "Herein, monks, when sensual desire is present in him, the monk knows there is sensual desire in me. Or when sensual desire is absent, he knows there is no sensual desire in me." Now, this is a really powerful statement, you know, of the mindfulness process in the sense that he has a clear knowledge, he has a clear sense an objective capacity to see that sensual desire is present, or that sensual desire is absent. In other words, he's not caught up, he's not identified with the sensual desire, and he's not involved in the desire itself without, and at the same time being unconscious that he's, you know, wrapped up in that particular desire. He actually sees the desire as it arises in him. Now, this is a statement of clear seeing, of mindfulness itself. He knows how the arising of non-arisen sensual desire comes to be. Now, this is really important. He knows how the arising of non-arisen sensual desire comes to be. In essence, what this says is he sees the cause and effect pattern through which this desire has arisen in him. In other words, he understands how this came to be. He's understanding karma, and this is one of the most powerful aspects of the mindfulness. When you start to see your emotions very, very clearly, you begin to have a sense of where this came from. You know, what was the cause and effect pattern that preceded or caused this emotion to arise, and basically has a clear sense or a clear understanding, you know, of how this all came to be. So this is sort of the arising of wisdom that begins to occur when you see these patterns of emotions, when you see these patterns of desire beginning to arise. He goes on to say he knows how the rejection of the arisen sensual desire comes to be, and he knows how the non-arising in the future of the rejected sensual desire comes to be. Now, this is really crucial. So he knows what it feels like to kind of let go, to not act upon that desire as it arises. So there's that moment of freedom, there's that moment of liberation, there's that moment of clarity, of letting go. You know, when he senses that feeling of control that he has over, you know, these emotions, these desires that keep welling up in him. So it's a refreshing, powerful sense of being able to kind of let go, to be able to manage, and to be able to work with or negotiate with these kinds of feelings as they arise. And he also knows how the non-arising in the future of the rejected sensual desire comes to be. In other words, in the clear seeing of these desires, in the clear seeing of these emotions, he not only sees how they arise or how they arose in him, but what the future consequences, what the implications of these, you know, of these emotions are. And through the actual ability to let go of these emotions, to not be afflicted by this kind of desire, he can see what his future will be when he becomes free of these desires. So this is really a statement of emotional freedom from suffering that comes through the mindfulness process. So this is really a statement of the dynamics that are involved in terms of what happens when a person focuses mindfully or uses mindfulness in terms of seeing emotions or seeing desire, craving, attachment, you know, as it arises, and the ability to kind of step away from it and to basically let go and to understand the implications, you know, of that action as he exercises that kind of mindfulness and wisdom. Jnanaponika goes on to address, you know, each of these hindrances individually. I'll concentrate on sensual desire. And he uses the word denourishment. It's a very powerful word. How to denourish, in other words, stop feeding these kinds of emotions, you know, as they arise. And he begins with a sort of definition of nourishment. And he says, just as, monks, this body lives on nourishment, lives depending on nourishment, does not live without nourishment, In the same way, monks, the five hindrances live on nourishment. Depend on nourishment. Do not live without nourishment. Now, this statement in itself is a really, really powerful statement in the sense that what he's saying is that what we experience as the five hindrances, or, you know, sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, these are mind states that we actually allow to occur by nourishing them in some fashion. So, you know, it sort of implies a kind of unconscious choice, unconscious in the sense that we're not aware that we're actually doing this, but in fact, we're actually facilitating the arising of these hindrances. So this is a very powerful statement. On the other hand, the way to manage or the way to control these mind states is by learning how to denourish them or take away the sustenance that allows these emotions, you know, to arise and propagate. So he begins by saying, there are beautiful objects, frequently giving unwise attention to them. This is the nourishment for the arising of sensual desire that has not arisen, and the nourishment for the increase and strengthening of sensual desire that has already arisen. So what it is that actually nourishes sensual desire is giving unwise attention, dwelling on these emotions. And as we dwell on them, like sensual desire, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And of course, this is called proliferation or prapancha. You know, we make something huge out of, you know, what we see. We sort of turn it into something bigger, you know, than it actually is. So how do we denourish, or how do we deflate, you know, these kinds of desires as they arise? And Jnanaponika cites a number of sort of strategies. Basically, sort of outlines six ways of denourishing sensual desire. One is to learning how to meditate on impure objects. And I'll describe this all in more detail later. Devoting oneself to the meditation on the impure. Third is learning how to guard the sense doors. Four is moderation in eating. Five is noble friendship. And six is suitable conversation. Now, the first one is learning how to meditate about impure objects. When we talk about this, it's important to remember that the emphasis here is on sensual desire. So it basically, you know, sort of implies desire for sensual pleasure, you know, perhaps sexual pleasure. But it also speaks about pleasures of the senses. You know, it could also imply the pleasure of taste, you know, like food, the pleasure of sound, pleasant sounds, the desire for pleasant sensations or pleasant thoughts, pleasant feelings. So it's really more pleasures of the senses, although a predominant emphasis is often on sensual desire or sexual desire. Basically, the teaching here is, it's stated as in the following way. In him who is devoted to the meditation about impure objects, repulsion towards beautiful objects is firmly established. And so the typical example is given as, you know, the cemetery meditations, in terms of meditating or sort of contemplating the loathsomeness, the ugliness of the human body, as opposed to, you know, how we attribute beauty, sort of the ideal of beauty, feminine beauty or masculine beauty, but looking at it in its inherent reality as simply, you know, the impurities of the human body. So the quotation goes something like this. Herein, monks, a monk reflects on just this body, confined within the skin and full of manifold impurities from the soles upward, from the top of the hair down. There in this body, hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, pleura, spleen, lungs, intestines, bowels, stomach, excrement, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, lymph, saliva, mucus, fluid of the joints, urine, and the brain and the skull. So this is, you know, these are the actual words, you know, of the sutras. And in the Sutta Nipata it says, by bones and sinews knit, with flesh and tissue smeared, and hidden by the skin, the body does not appear as it really is. The fool thinks it's beautiful, his ignorance misguiding him. So the whole point is that we don't really see the reality of what the body actually is. You know, what we're seeing is just, you know, the surface, you know, the surface qualities, the nose, the eyes, the skin, the mouth, the hair. And, you know, we have these idealized conceptions of what beauty is, you know, male beauty or female beauty. But we don't really see the reality of what the body is. It's just this mass of skin, bone, and blood. And so if we were to really see it, you know, in its sort of impure state, if you will, it would have a really sobering effect in terms of how we actually appreciate other human beings or how we see them as really who they are, as opposed to, you know, sort of our idealized conception of what we would like them to look like. So anyway, there's a number of other strategies. The other one is actually, you know, guarding the sense doors. So how does one guard the sense doors? Herein, a monk, having seen a form, does not seize upon its delusive appearance as a whole, nor on its details. If his sense of sight were uncontrolled, covetousness, grief, and other evil, unwholesome states would flow into him. Therefore, he practices for the sake of its control. He watches over the sense of sight. He enters upon its control. Having heard a sound, smelt an odor, tasted a taste, felt a touch, cognized a mental object, he does not seize upon its delusive appearance as a whole. He enters upon its control. Now, the quote goes on, there are forms perceptible by the eye which are desirable, lovely, pleasing, agreeable, associated with desire, arousing lust. If the monk does not delight in them, is not attached to them, does not welcome them, then in him, thus not delighting in them, not being attached to them, and not welcoming them, delight in these forms ceases. If delight is absent, there is no bondage. There are sounds perceptible by the ear, odors perceptible by the mind. If delight is absent, there is no bondage. So the basic sort of idea here is how we express our attachment to pleasure, how we express or embody our expression of attraction, pleasure, desire, liking, you know, of forms, you know, forms which are pleasing, lovely, agreeable. But if we do not welcome them, if we control our expression of attachment, delight, and pleasure, and see them truly as they are, not in terms of how we project our concepts of beauty or pleasure on them, that is a, you know, a really powerful strategy for, you know, controlling how we get hooked by pleasurable, sensual, or sensory kinds of experiences. Now, going back to the first paragraph, where the monk watches over the sense of sight, he enters upon its control. And when he hears a sound, he just hears a sound. When he smells an odor, he just smells the odor. You know, he doesn't make anything out of it. He doesn't turn it into something else. When he tastes a taste, he doesn't build it into something that it's not. It's simply a taste. There was a famous story of the Buddha toward the end of his life as he was on one of his final journeys. He was approached by a monk or sage who basically approached him and asked him to give him a Dharma talk, to give him words of wisdom, right on the spot. And Ananda, who was the Buddha's, sort of assistant, of course, was quite annoyed. And he said, can't you see this man is very sick and unable to give a discourse at this point? So please, let him go. But then the Buddha said, Ananda, that's okay. And so, please, sir, ask your question. The sage said, basically asked him, what is the essence of the teaching? So the Buddha basically said, I can't remember the exact phrasing of the story, but he basically said, when you hear a sound, just hear a sound. When you see a sight, just see a sight. Nothing more, nothing less. And at that moment, the sage reached enlightenment. In other words, what the Buddha was saying was, what causes suffering is when we overlay kind of layers of meaning, layers of conceptual embellishments on our experience, on our raw experience, when you hear a sound or when you taste a taste, which make it better, which give us a sense that it's better than it actually is or worse than it actually is. And we sort of build it up in our mind to the extent that we begin to derive sort of inordinate amounts of pleasure or inordinate amounts of aversion, to what we're experiencing. And this is the nature of suffering in the sense that we create this whole sort of structure of proliferating thoughts that turn something that we experience into something else. It's sort of a projection of our own ideas about the experience rather than the experience itself. I'll speak about this a lot more as we get further into this material, because this all basically has to do with conditioning and the effect that conditioning has on us in terms of distorting our view of reality and our ability to actually see things as they actually are, as opposed to what we think they are, which is affected by our conditioning process. Then Jhanaponika goes on discussing several other strategies, moderation in eating. The point here is that the monk takes his food not for the purposes of enjoyment, of pride, or beautifying the body, or showing his culinary arrogance, like he eats certain kinds of foods or things like that, but simply for the sake of maintaining and sustaining his body, to avoid harm and to support the holy life. And so he doesn't use food as a social expression. He just simply uses food as a form of life-sustaining nourishment. The same in the way of noble friendship, where the whole notion of noble friendship is that a wise person who cultivates the path of spiritual understanding and wisdom spends his time with like-minded folks, like-minded people, so that they reinforce that process of mindfulness and wisdom with each other, rather than being in the company of people who are sensuous and would tend to sort of draw one down the path toward sensual desire and unskillful, unwholesome actions. In the same sense, suitable conversation is a way of reinforcing positive and wholesome and skillful activities. So, in a nutshell, this summarizes the classical discussion of central desire. But what I'd like to do is expand this discussion just a little bit in terms of generalizing this whole notion of central desire. To begin with, I think we need to expand the definition of desire, craving, greed or wanting. Basically, there, in the Pali description or definition of the word desire, there's sort of two levels of desire. The Pali term is chanda, or desire is defined as the desire to do something, in the sense of, kind of wholesome aspiration to achieve something, in the world. And of course, the Buddha himself embodied the desire to attain spiritual awakening, and that was the desire that empowered his spiritual journey, his search, which eventually resulted in his enlightenment and the birth of and the beginning of his dispensation and his teaching and his legacy to the world. In the same way, we have desires to gain an education, to establish ourselves in the world, to help others. So desire, has a positive, wholesome sort of meaning, in the sense of wanting to do something skillful, wanting to do something of benefit to oneself and to mankind, to the community, in a wholesome sort of positive way. But then there is the desire, the sort of that we speak of in terms of central desire, and that word is tanha in Pali. That word has the meaning of greed, of craving, of wanting, of the sense of covetousness. As Jnanaponika says, unrestrained covetousness. So what I'd like to do, however, is focusing on tanha, or the concept of craving. First of all, I'd like to sort of expand the sort of definition of craving within the larger context, the push and pull of desire and aversion, or, one of the most famous foundational sort of sayings in the Buddhist literature is, life is comprised of greed, hatred, and delusion. Greed in the sense that we're constantly chasing after things that we desire and things that we can't get, and running away from things that we don't want, things that we're averse to, things that we dislike. And the delusion, of course, is not knowing that this is what we're doing, that the sense of unconsciousness, that we're living these lives of craving and aversion and not even being aware that this is what we're doing, which is in turn the definition of suffering. So this is a very important foundational concept in terms of being able to understand the nature of the teaching, with regard to this whole notion of desire or central desire and aversion, which we'll talk about in terms of ill will, which is the second sort of major hindrance. So what I'd like to do is kind of expand this definition in terms of desire or greed or craving, into what we find attractive, what we like, what we find pleasant. We aspire to gain, to acquire those things, those objects, those experiences, those feelings that are pleasant, that are pleasurable. And we avoid and we're repulsed by or we feel aversion toward those experiences and objects that we regard as unpleasant or we dislike. I think the whole point here is that this pattern of attraction and repulsion, or liking or disliking, or pleasant and unpleasant, these are patterns that of preference, if you will, personal preference, that we learn through our conditioning process. In essence, everything that we consider to be pleasant or unpleasant or desirable or undesirable are patterns that we learn, that we're conditioned in through the conditions of our childhood, our family, our upbringing, our community, the circumstances of our lives. So this is all dependent on the circumstances within which we've been raised. And so in essence, you can say that this is all a sort of conditioned process. And this is the essence of conditioning. So how we experience the world, how we express our preferences for pleasant or unpleasant, or experiences and objects that we like as opposed to dislike, that we are attracted to as opposed to repulsed by, is a very specific pattern of preference that we learn, that has been conditioned, that has been taught to us, from our earliest childhood. And to a certain extent, they describe what we would call our ego. Ego is, in essence, all of the thoughts, all of the preferences, all of the choices, all of the desires, the rights and the wrongs, the goods, the bads, the pleasants, the unpleasants, that we embody, sort of in our mind. And so they create a certain identity. They create a certain way of seeing the world that is unique, and it expresses, who we are. So what we've come around to doing is basically defining what our ego is, and in doing so, sort of articulate the fact that it's actually a conditioned artifact. It's not something that's essentially real, or immutable, or immortal, or unchangeable, or, substantial in the sense of being unchangeable in any way. It's a completely conditioned, circumstantial, dependent phenomenon, dependent on conditions, dependent on circumstances. And this is really the core of the Buddha's teaching in terms of understanding what is non-self. So what we regard as self is really kind of an artificial, kind of a circumstantial entity, but doesn't reflect any true, immortal, sort of immutable, unchangeable, solid, real kind of self, in the sense that we sometimes think we are. We're actually a conditioned phenomenon. Now, another way of kind of amplifying this whole notion of these patterns of liking and disliking and attraction, repulsion, and pleasant, unpleasant, and taking it a little deeper in the sense of our subconscious and perhaps even unconscious, patterns of behavior and patterns of preference, is to see pattern of wanting, the pattern in terms of need, in terms of how we respond to patterns of need in our life. So it's a little bit less conscious. It's not about wanting, it's about what we need and how we respond to that need. And this gets into the realm of attachments, or upadana, in the Pali sense of the word. And patterns of identification, the things we identify with. But for example, starting with attachments, there isn't a person in the world who is not attached, to certain things. Like, we're attached to our parents, our mother, our father, our wives, our husbands, or our sons and our daughters, or our relatives. We're attached to our culture, the American culture, or European culture, or African, or Asian, or Chinese, or Filipino, or whatever our nationality might be. We're attached to our religion, whether it's Christianity, Buddhism, or Islam, or Hinduism. We're attached to our ethnicity. This is a big one, whether we're Caucasian, or Asian, or African, or Middle Eastern, Egyptian. And these attachments create a sense of identity. You know, oftentimes, for better or for worse, you know, we might feel a sense of superiority, or we might feel a sense of inferiority. And, you know, these attachments color the way we see the world. They certainly color the way we see our experience, you know, whether they help to determine whether something is pleasant, unpleasant, or attractive, or repulsive. And even deeper than that, our patterns of identification, you know, the things that we identify with that define who we think we are, our identity. For example, our identification with roles, our roles as mothers, our roles as fathers, our roles as sons and daughters and bosses and employees, or our professional roles as artists, musicians, lawyers, doctors, you know, janitors or street cleaners or construction workers, our identification with, you know, for example, you know, illnesses and diseases, you know, people who have cancer, people who have schizophrenia or mental illness. We identify with our life condition. And the reason we do this is because this identification gives us a sense of self. It gives us a sense of identity. It gives us a sense of who we are. It gives us a sense of position in the world and, you know, in relationship to other people. So this is an important process. It's not, I'm not saying it's bad, but it's how we manifest in the world. We, you know, we manifest in roles and identities, and we carry many identities in the process of one lifetime. But these roles and identities, which constitute, you know, along with our conditioning process, you know, our egos, right? This is who we are. Colors and in a way distorts how we view our experience, you know, in terms of what we're attracted to and what we're repulsed by, what we like and what we dislike, what we desire and what we don't desire. These are all sort of affected by, you know, our sense of our identity, our sense of what we're attached to in the world. You know, for example, if we see ourselves as being upper class or middle class or lower class or cultured and refined, or, you know, which is what a lot of people aspire to, this determines, you know, what we see or what we think is beautiful, what we think is repulsive. And it's all about our ego. And in a way, this is part of life. This is part of survival. This is part of, you know, sort of the sort of Darwinian kind of natural selection process in terms of how we get along in the world. So this is not to say it's all bad. This is to say that this is how we live in the world. But at the same time, how we live in the world in terms of how we express ourselves through our ego manifestation does affect how we experience the world. And in effect, it creates this lens of what some teachers or what some spiritual masters would say, delusion or illusion or kind of rose-colored glasses, because it creates a certain distorted view of the world based on our conditioning, based on our identities, based on our attachments, that colors the way we experience the world. So really we have to understand sensual desire or even ill will, you know, as a function of our conditioning. And the point here, of course, is that it's not that the conditioning is bad. The conditioning is part of who we are. It's part of, you know, how we survive and how we manifest in the world. But it's not the totality of who we are. It represents a personal view, if you will, a kind of expression of our ego, an expression of our preferences, which is a function of our ego and a function of, you know, what our conception of our identity in the world is. But that's not actually, you know, the total reality of what's actually there. One of the sort of most powerful sort of examples of this is an experience I had once. I was studying with a teacher by the name of Dr. Tintin, and she's a Burmese teacher who came to Hawaii and gave a series of retreats here. And she has a center in Sebastopol, California. So one year I went up and I did a retreat at her center, and she teaches what is called a mindfulness in daily living. So it's or mindfulness off the cushion, OTC. And what that is sort of the application of mindfulness, this sense of spacious awareness, you know, to our daily experience in the world as we move about in the everyday world, as opposed to, you know, when we're in meditation. So it's a rather unique sort of approach. And, you know, so one that resonated very deeply with me. But anyway, we had this workshop, and I remember one particular event where, you know, we were sort of, a group of us were gathered in a circle in her living room. And so she asked us to sort of look around the room and select an object in the room that somehow had resonance for us. So we took a moment, and we all looked around. So after a while, she said, okay, so I'd like you to describe the object that you chose and explain, you know, what attracted you to that object. So, you know, she asked this one woman to begin. And I remember this very clearly. It was, she said, well, I chose this coat that this other person was wearing. It really kind of spoke to me. And so, you know, Dr. Tintin asked, well, you know, well, what was the reason? And she said, well, it's made of cashmere. And it looks like a very refined cashmere. And it kind of reminded me of my mother, who used to love cashmere. And she had this beautiful kind of fur-lined cashmere coat. And as a child, I used to see my mother wearing this coat, and it looked so elegant and so refined and so beautiful on my mother. And I always had this image, you know, of this cashmere coat, and it speaks to me of culture and refinement and, you know, and status, you know. And it was something that kind of really attracted me. So we all were listening to this, and Dr. Tintin said, well, you know, it's just a coat, you know, and it's just cloth, you know, cashmere is just cloth. And there was this moment of silence, and it was quite extraordinary, you know, almost this light sort of went on. And we all realized that, yeah, it was just a cloth, you know, it's just a cloth coat. And I remember this woman, this look on her face, and she just got it. You know, it's just like this whole sort of resonance that she was feeling, this sense of attachment to that coat, was really just a function of her projection, you know, of her experience, of her desire, of her memories of her mother. So it was all this constructed image in her mind of this coat, which really had nothing to do with the coat at all. It was just, you know, the memory that she carried in her mind of her mother. And then there was another one which was very interesting. It was a young man, and he selected a piece of sculpture that was sitting on the shelf, and it was a wooden carving of a man sort of working, you know, sort of in the rice paddies, and he was sort of carrying this big heavy load on his back, and he was kind of stooped over. He was wearing a conical sort of coolie hat. And so the young man said, well, it sort of reminds me of the suffering of the human condition. Here's this man stooped over and working so hard, and you know, he probably doesn't have much to eat, and he's, you know, this poor, struggling a person. And he gave this rather eloquent, you know, kind of explanation of why this kind of resonated for him, you know, like the suffering of humankind. And we were all sitting, and Dr. Tintin was listening, and finally, you know, she said to him, well, you know, it's just, you know, a piece of wood with some carving in it. And there it was, you know, it was the same thing. It was, the reality of it was just a piece of wood, you know, with a few cuts in it that happened to look like a man. And yet, in his mind, he had built up this huge projection, this huge story around this piece of wood. So, you know, the lesson of this was quite clear to all of us. And it was basically desire, or what we regard as pleasant or desirable or what we like, is really a function of what we project onto the object. It has nothing to do with the object itself. It has nothing to do with the inherent reality of what we're actually looking at, but it's really a function of our projection. And of course, all of this projection, you know, if you listen to what these people were saying, is, you know, is a function of their conditioning. You know, like this woman's experience of seeing her mother wearing this cashmere coat. It's all about conditioning. It's all about, you know, cause and effect, and how our experience of the world is created by the conditions of our development, you know, from children all the way up through adulthood. You know, in a sense, all of this is nothing but a kind of illusion. This illusion of self, this illusion of ego, that prevents us from actually experiencing things as they truly are. And so this gets to, you know, the final point that I sort of wanted to sort of discuss, and that is, you know, how does mindfulness, how does meditation help us to see this pattern of delusion, to see the projections that we project onto objects, that we project onto our experience, you know, our entire sort of sensory, you know, experience of the world, you know, in terms of hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, seeing. What is the reality that we create out of this raw, so sort of the raw data of our experience, you know, that creates this whole kind of delusory sense of self, that sense of who we are in the world? And how this process can lead to patterns of suffering in terms of, you know, wanting, craving, and desire, and aversion, and sort of repulsion, and rejection, and negative emotions, anger, and sadness, and grief. This is exactly what mindfulness does. Mindfulness allows us to begin to open to the nature of what we're feeling, the nature of what we're experiencing, and seeing them in their inherent reality as forms of suffering, as forms of attachment, as forms of identification that distort our experience and distort our understanding of the world and our ability to see things as they truly are. Now, the way this happens, of course, is through the process of concentration, the process of quieting our discursive thinking mind, quieting all of these random thoughts, all these likes and dislikes and preferences and judgments, and allowing ourselves to come into a sense of mental stillness, mental silence. And out of that silence, you know, through, you know, the process of attaining, you know, what we call neighborhood concentration or momentary concentration, samadhi, out of this mental silence, you know, experience thoughts, feelings, and emotions that arise from a deeper level, and being able to experience them without reaction, without judgment, without commentary, you know, without sort of making things bigger than they are or less than they are, you know, through the discursive mind. In other words, we're putting the ego aside for a moment, and we're simply experiencing things as they are without the lens of our judging, reacting, in our minds. This is the capacity to begin to see things as they truly are, without, you know, the embellishment, without the judgments and the reactions of our discursive mind. So it's this process of mindfulness that begins to allow us to see things, you know, as they truly are, and to see the nature of our attachments and how these attachments can begin to distort the reality that we think we're seeing, but we're not actually seeing. Thank you very much.